The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And, of course, this week we'll be reading from the Friday edition, dated May 13th, 2011. And let's begin the program with our first story, the main story, and there are several related ones this week. At last, Bin Laden is gone. What happened? After a decade on the run, Osama bin Laden was killed this week in a daring U.S. Special Operations Forces raid on his hideout in a custom-built walled compound in Pakistan. Acting on orders from President Obama, 79 elite Navy SEALs descended by helicopter on Abbottabad, an affluent suburb 35 miles north of the Pakistani capital of Islamabad, which U.S. intelligence had pinpointed as the likely hiding place of the al-Qaeda founder and leader. Following a 40-minute firefight during which U.S. officials said five people were killed, including bin Laden's son, Hamza, bin Laden was found in an upstairs bedroom. He was unarmed, but attempted to resist capture, U.S. officials said, and was killed by a shot to the head. The SEALs left the compound with a trove of computer hard drives, thumb drives, and documents, as well as bin Laden's corpse. His body was later buried in the Arabian Sea by the U.S. aircraft carrier Carl Vinson so as to deny his followers a shrine. The raid on bin Laden's hiding place was years in the making. As far back as 2002, reported the New York Times, captured al-Qaeda members told interrogators about a trusted courier who was close to bin Laden. But under waterboarding and other torture methods, 9/11 chief planner Khalid Sheikh Mohammed said the courier was retired and of little significance. Another captured leader, also steering interrogators away from the courier, which suggested to U.S. intelligence that he might be the key to finding bin Laden. Over time, the U.S. learned that man's identity by putting more agents on the ground in Pakistan, and last August, they tracked him to the compound in Abbottabad. After ruling out bombing the compound because it would make his remains impossible to identify, President Obama ordered the commando strike last Friday. Once bin Laden's death was confirmed Sunday night, Obama told the nation that the 10-year search for the world's most wanted terrorist was over. Justice has been done, Obama said. Now here's what the editorials had to say. At last, Americans can shake off the sense of pessimism and failure they felt, but rarely acknowledged, in not being able to apprehend bin Laden for so long, said the Philadelphia Inquirer. Our country still faces huge challenges in Afghanistan and Iraq, but with the architect of 9/11 now dead, it's easier to envision a day not too long from now when the wars are over. The troops come home, and optimism reigns. And although it took us a decade to get our man, said the Kansas City Star, our dogged determination sends an important message to our enemies. If you do what bin Laden did, the United States will find you, no matter where you hide, no matter how long it takes. President Obama deserves credit for using special operations forces to settle this score rather than an unmanned drone, said the Wall Street Journal. Had the operation failed, second-guessers would have torn Obama apart. But he made a gutsy decision knowing that a U.S. military raid was worth the gamble because it would end once and for all the myth that bin Laden couldn't be taken. Al-Qaeda's remaining leaders must be having night sweats, said the Chicago Tribune, especially given the delicious trove of electronic booty the SEALs found in bin Laden's hideout. More commando raids and predator attacks could be in the offing. Now here's what the columnist said. The death of bin Laden proves that torture doesn't work, said Andrew Sullivan in the DailyBeast.com. Despite being waterboarded 183 times, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed actually lied about the courier's name and importance. So did another al-Qaeda leader, Abu Faraj Alibi. What broke this case was old-fashioned intelligence work and Obama's decision to refocus on capturing bin Laden. But you can't dismiss waterboarding's effectiveness so easily, said Shannon Coffin in NationalReview.com. When Mohammed was captured in 2003, he was resistant to any form of interrogation, conventional or otherwise. Waterboarding and other enhanced measures made him more compliant later, and interrogators were able to deduce from his responses clues about the courier. One thing is certain. It's time we stopped moaning about the decline of American power, said Victor Davis Hanson, also in NationalReview.com. No other country is capable of pulling off an operation of the sort that killed bin Laden. So ignore all the fashionable talk about a post-America. American military might has radical Islam on the run. Obama now appears more willing to use that power, said Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. For too long, the president has shown a counterproductive sensitivity for the sensitivities of the Muslim world, intervening abroad only when UN approval. With UN approval, by sending in the commandos to take out bin Laden, whether or not Pakistan or anyone else liked it, Obama has broken free from a straitjacket of his own making. What poetic justice that bin Laden died at the exact moment he was being made irrelevant by the Arab Spring, said Cynthia Tucker in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. None of the wave of democratic uprisings transforming the Islamic world were inspired by his twisted, despotic version of Islam. They were fueled by people he hated, including well-educated women and young Muslims who want the chance to vote in free and open elections, and to see how irrelevant bin Laden has become in the Muslim world, said Fuad Ajami in the Wall Street Journal. You just have to look at the revolution that ended Hosni Mubarak's dictatorial reign in Egypt. No one in Liberation Square chanted bin Laden's name or shouted death to America. Instead, in their own peaceful way, they settled their account with the dictator and signaled their desire for a free, modern society. The next article here related to this one is Al-Qaeda after bin Laden. Osama bin Laden's death has dealt a powerful psychological blow to Al-Qaeda, leaving the terrorist organization without a single symbolic leader, analysts said this week. While bin Laden was unable to exercise operational control of terrorist plots while in hiding, the analyst said his defiance of the U.S. and militant Islamic rhetoric remained a powerful inspiration to terrorist recruiters and fundraisers around the world. His death may thus mark a turning point in the war against terrorism. Clearly, this doesn't end the threat from Al-Qaeda, said Juan Zarate, a national security advisor to George W. Bush, but it deprives Al-Qaeda of its core leader, and that void may unleash internal divisions and fractures within the government. Ayman al-Zawahiri, bin Laden's top deputy, is his likely successor, but he's a divisive figure who lacks bin Laden's charisma and connections, said Ali H. Sofan, an FBI special agent and Al-Qaeda interrogator. Al-Zawahiri faces ambitious rivals in Yemen and Somalia, Sufan said, and his Egyptian nationality is a major mark against him in an organization dominated by members from the Persian Gulf states. In recent years, Al-Qaeda has evolved into a decentralized movement with smaller cells, new leaders, and other sanctuaries, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The Yemen-based Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is now perhaps the most dangerous of those affiliates. AQAP has played a role in two terrorist plots against the U.S. mainland since 2009 and is led by a tested bin Laden associate from Afghanistan. Another leader of the group, the young Yemeni-American cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, has started an English-language magazine intended to recruit Western Muslims. Al-Qaeda was in decline before bin Laden's death, and that decline will almost certainly accelerate, said Louis Clararis in NewRepublic.com. U.S. drone strikes and military operations have killed hundreds of Al-Qaeda's most fanatical militants and left its senior leadership in disarray. Al-Qaeda's attacks on Muslim civilians in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other countries, meanwhile, have turned Muslim opinion against the terrorist group, with support for bin Laden falling in Pakistan, for example, from 46% in 2003 to 18% last year. We're winning the war, but it's not yet won. Decapitating Al-Qaeda will not stop those who feel it is their duty to strike against the U.S. and its assets in the name of bin Laden's twisted version of Islam. And the third related item here in the main story section of the Week magazine this week is entitled The Threat of Terrorist Revenge. The United States and other Western nations this week heightened security, with officials saying it's likely that Islamic radicals will try to avenge Osama bin Laden's killing with a new act of terrorism. Anti-terror networks in the U.S., Europe, Africa, and the Southeast Asia were put on high alert as rumors surfaced that the Al-Qaeda founder had recorded a doomsday tape encouraging his supporters to retaliate in the event of his death. Terrorists almost certainly will attempt to avenge him, said CIA Director Leon Panetta. New York City police beefed up patrols at Ground Zero, and on the subway, synagogues and mosques got extra coverage in Philadelphia and Los Angeles, and federal buildings were put under heightened protection in Washington, D.C. Terrorists now face a new deterrent, said David Barno in the New York Times. Bin Laden's killing reminds his disciples that the U.S. is a power to be reckoned with. Al-Qaeda now knows that any attack on U.S. soil will be met with a ferocious response that will not end until justice is served. Shorn of bin Laden's grand ambitions, Al-Qaeda is less apt to mount another spectacular mass casualty outrage, said Julian Borger in the London Guardian. But that hardly means we are safe. The real threat are lone wolf attacks by angry fanatics seeking to join bin Laden in glorious martyrdom. The constant menace of an attack on a cafe or a plane will be with us for some time to come. That threat is not new, said Juliet K.M. in the Boston Globe. How we live with it is. Our government's formerly excited posture on terrorism has changed to one of resolute calmness. The new watchwords, secretly kill, publicly chill, Homeland Security didn't even issue a new alert this week because no specifics on future attacks emerged to warrant freaking everyone out. We may not be safer, but we're better at coping with the nature of the world we live in. And that is no small victory. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine for Friday, May 13th. 2011. Our next item is the controversy of the week, entitled Obama, Will His Bin Laden Bump Last? The job of those working to stop Barack Obama's re-election just got a lot harder, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. During his 2008 campaign, Obama pledged to do what George W. Bush had failed to accomplish, to hunt down and kill Osama bin Laden. Making good on that promise adds to his stature as leader in a way that few other events could have done. 2 days after Obama's announcement that bin Laden was dead triggered celebrations and relief across the nation. Polls found that the president's approval rating had jumped about 10 points to 57%. The spike in Obama's poll numbers is bound to subside, said Andrew Sullivan in the DailyBeast.com. But in my view, the president who found and killed Osama bin Laden will be very hard not to reelect. The big lie that Obama is a weak, dithering Muslim sympathizer was emphatically debunked in the hail of bullets in Abbottabad. It certainly will be hard to run against Obama for the next few weeks, said Jonathan Bernstein in WashingtonPost.com, but the election won't happen for 19 months. In the past, these rally-round-the-flag effects have been very short-lived. President George H.W. Bush, for example, had an 89% approval rating after launching the first Gulf War in 1991, yet he lost to Bill Clinton just a year later. The news this week is all about bin Laden, said Jonathan Chait in NewRepublic.com. For most of the remaining 80 weeks between now and the next presidential election, the news will once again be about unemployment, rising gas prices, and the perilous state of the U.S. economy. Come Election Day 2012, the impact of bin Laden's death will be minimal to non-existent. For some other president, that might be true, said William Dobson, also in NewRepublic.com, but not for this particular president. Obama up to now showed no foreign policy toughness, and Democrats have had a long series of bungled commando operations. Jimmy Carter's failed hostage rescue mission in Iran, Bill Clinton's Black Hawk Down, and yet Obama turned down the safe chance to bomb bin Laden from 30,000 feet, ordering a high-risk nighttime commando raid that killed the most notorious terrorist leader in history, whisked his corpse away, and confirmed his identity. The Republicans' attempt to caricature Obama as another Jimmy Carter is now over. Obama didn't just help his own image, said Peter Beinart in thedailybeast.com. With this one gutsy decision, he may have freed the whole Democratic Party from the wimpy reputation that Republicans have labored decades to build. That's utter nonsense, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. Obama made the right decision here, and he deserves his bin Laden bump in the polls. But U.S. voters aren't about to forget this dithering over Afghanistan and Libya, or the flip-flop over closing Guantanamo Bay, or any of the dozen other occasions where he chose vacillation and compromise over decisive leadership. I agree that killing bin Laden isn't enough to win Obama re-election, said Steve Bannon and WashingtonMonthly.com. I also agree that a lot can happen between now and November 2012. But Obama's putting together a long list of accomplishments with which to sell himself to the voters, ending the Great Recession, reforming the health care system, reforming Wall Street, repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and, oh yes, he's killed Osama bin Laden too. Is that a winning message? Well, I've heard worse. And now let's turn to a little bit lighter side of the news. I'm sure you're ready for that. Let's listen to the popular column, Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4 from The Week magazine. It was a good week for Donita Weddle of East Wenatchee, Washington, after her husband Gary, 50, finally shaved off the scraggly foot-long beard he vowed 10 years ago to keep up until Osama bin Laden was caught. I wanted him to get rid of it, but it was his vow, said Donita. It was a good week for role reversal after a prison inmate at the Erie County Correctional Facility in New York broke up a fight between two corrections officers who began brawling over a bag of chips. And it was a good week for baby steps. After the Alabama Senate approved a bill that would eliminate language from its century-old state constitution that calls for poll taxes and separate schools for black and white students. When a similar bill was passed in 2004, it was defeated in a statewide referendum. It was a bad week for enlightened management after the Chinese factories that make iPhones and iPads responded to a wave of suicides by overworked assembly line employees by forcing new workers to sign pledges that they would not kill themselves. It was a bad week for Judy Baranich, a middle school English teacher in Middleburg, Pennsylvania, who was outed by parents as Judy Mays, the author of erotic romance novels. Said one upset parent, I don't want my son sitting in her class thinking, is she looking at him in a certain way? And it was a bad week for delusions after three Englishmen who tried to sail across the English Channel on a 7-foot dinghy greeted rescuers 11 hours later by saying bonjour, believing they'd reached France. They were actually just 2 miles away from where they started. And And so much for Good Week 4, Bad Week 4 for this particular week. And now let's turn to the People section of the Week magazine. The first item is entitled Larry the Lion in Winter. Larry Fortensky will forever be known as Liz Taylor's hunky last husband, said Caroline Graham in the London Daily Mail. Taylor caused an uproar in 1991 when she married Fortensky, then a construction worker with long blonde hair whom she called Larry the Lion. They met at the Betty Ford Center. Elizabeth was in there for pills. I was in there for beer, said Fortensky, who is now 59. We had an instant physical attraction. She was funny and sweet. Of course, she was very pretty. I wasn't too bad-looking either in those days. He was also 20 years younger, but Liz made Larry her eighth husband at a wedding at Michael Jackson's Neverland Ranch, with paparazzi and helicopters whirling overhead. Fortensky found himself sailing on Taylor's yacht and traveling the world. We had a dinner in Japan that cost $30,000. The beef had been hand-massaged or something. At home, Taylor's chauffeur delivered his lunch to the construction site. It was so embarrassing. The guys would rib me about it. They divorced in 1996, and Fortensky's life went downhill. A decade ago, he fell down a flight of stairs while drunk and is now bloated and reclusive. He says, however, that he and Liz stayed in touch over the years and that she left him $800,000 in her will. I love her. I always will, he says. And I know that she loved me, too. The next item, the perfume world's rebel. Christopher Brosius isn't your average perfumer, said Jeffrey Gray in New York Magazine. Known as the Willy Wonka of the perfume world, he's earned his reputation by crafting such eccentric scents as wet mitten, roast beef, and clean baby butt. While most of the world's leading perfume makers train their noses in France, Brosius' education started when he drove heavily perfumed women in a New York City cab in the 1980s. Those were the Giorgio days, he says. Miserable. He began working at a perfume counter, mixing high-end perfumes like a bartender for celebrity clients such as Cindy Crawford. Later, he threw himself into the serious study of scent. He delights in creating unconventional smells. People who smell like everyone else disgust me, he says. That whole let's find the universal thing, which I know is big in the perfume world. Well, how boring is that? Lately, he's been putting the finishing touches on his masterpiece, a complex admixture of jasmine, sandalwood, and amber, intended to smell like nothing. It's not going to smell the same on each person, he says. It smells like us. It smells human. And our third item from the People's section of the Week magazine, Seymour's Change of Heart. Stephanie Seymour is learning how to make do, said William Norwich in Town and Country. For 2 years, the ex-supermodel, who is 42 now, was caught up in a nasty divorce battle with her husband, billionaire entrepreneur Peter Brandt, 64, whom she married in 1995. After years of feeling like a trophy wife, Seymour decided she wanted out. In court, Brandt accused her of adultery and addiction to painkillers. She accused him of bullying her and her children. It got out of control, she says. Sickened by the rancor, she sank into depression and sometimes wouldn't leave her room for days. I felt I had disappointed everyone, that I was causing my children so much pain, she says. At some point, she decided the divorce had taken on a life of its own. It's fueled by people you're paying. It's the lawyers talking and not you. And it hurts so many people. So to the surprise of everyone, she had a private chat with Brandt and told him she didn't want the divorce. They sent their lawyers packing. Their revived marriage still has its problems, she admits, but working on it is preferable to the alternative. I love my husband and I always will. I'm not perfect, he's not perfect, but what we have done is tried to come together. ¶¶ And now let's turn to the briefing for this week from The Week magazine. This week it's entitled, The Problem with Medicare. The cost of providing medical care to senior citizens is helping to fuel trillion-dollar deficits. Why is Medicare so expensive? How did Medicare originate? It was a Democratic dream for decades. President Franklin Roosevelt first tried in 1934 to establish government-mandated universal health insurance, but he never won the support of Republicans or the general public. In the 1950s, Democrats introduced a modified plan to provide health care solely for the elderly. President John Kennedy threw his weight behind that proposal in 1962, but his assassination stalled an attempt to pass a bill that followed the following year. When President Lyndon Johnson finally got Medicare through in 1965, he enrolled former President Harry Truman, then 81 years old, as its first beneficiary. Upon receiving his Medicare card at the bill's signing, Truman said no U.S. citizen should ever be abandoned to the indignity of charity or suffer hopeless despair. Was support widespread? Absolutely not. The healthcare industry was aghast, and Republicans warned that socialized medicine would pave America's path to totalitarianism. Ronald Reagan, then a politically ambitious television actor, had predicted in a 1961 LP recorded for the American Medical Association that Medicare would doom Americans to spend their sunset years telling their children what it once was like in America when men were free. In the end, though, some Republicans supported the 1965 bill in return for concessions that strengthened the roles of doctors and private insurance companies in the program. What exactly does Medicare cover? It pays for hospital care for those age 65 and over, and heavily subsidizes their doctor's services and drugs. But it's not free. Almost all seniors pay monthly premiums for some parts of Medicare, and many enroll in a supplemental insurance plan, Medigap, to help cover out-of-pocket costs. Currently, around 1 in 8 Americans, or almost 47 million people, are enrolled in Medicare. How much does it cost? Well, in 2010, the total bill came to $524 billion, or 15.2% of government spending. Only Social Security and National Defense cost the taxpayer more. Costs are projected to grow at approximately 5.4% every year for the next decade and to hit $1 trillion in the early 2020s. All American workers are required to pay 2.9% of their annual wages, salaries, and compensation in Medicare taxes. But these contributions cover less than half the program's cost. A 56-year-old couple today with average earnings will end up paying around $140,000 in Medicare taxes over their lifetimes, but can expect to receive about $430,000 in benefits. Why is it so expensive? Partly it's demographics. As baby boomers enter retirement and life expectancy increases, more seniors are drawing on Medicare benefits for ever longer periods of time. And as medical care becomes more sophisticated, its costs rise. Heart patients once prescribed nitroglycerin pills, for instance, now get triple bypass operations. But the Medicare system itself is partly to blame. Doctors and hospitals make more money the more often they see patients, prescribe expensive drugs, and perform elective procedures. So they do so, in the knowledge that Medicare will pick up the tab. On top of that, outright fraud and abuse cost Medicare $70 billion every year. Unscrupulous doctors know that because so many claims are getting paid, there's a very good chance they're not going to get caught, said Medicare official Kim Brandt. How does the president propose fixing Medicare? The Affordable Care Act of 2010, known to its critics as Obamacare, starts out by cutting Medicare payments to private insurers and doctors and taxing high-income recipients. but it also aims to control costs. In some cases, it would pay health care providers an overall fee for managing specific medical conditions, rather than per procedure fees that encourage overtreatment. The new law also establishes an independent payment advisory board made up of experts who will monitor outcomes and authorize only the most cost-effective drugs and treatments. And the Republicans? Representative Paul Ryan's plan, put forward as part of his 2012 budget proposal, would essentially replace Medicare with an annual government subsidy of up to $15,000 per person. Retirees would use their vouchers to buy one of several competing private insurance policies certified by Medicare. Because the subsidy would be limited and insurers unwilling to lose money, seniors could wind up paying far more out of their pockets or make do with less medical care. Ryan exempts anyone now over 55 from the new program to make it more politically palatable. What's the public's preference? Polls show that roughly two-thirds of Americans want Medicare kept just as it is. Even 7 out of 10 self-identified Tea Partiers oppose cuts. The status quo, however, is not an option. If Medicare spending keeps growing at the current rate, health care costs will eat up nearly a third of the U.S. economy by 2035. Unless we confront that reality, says Greg Blotch, a physician and law professor at Georgetown University, the costs of medical care will consume us. The Swiss solution. Switzerland has proved that it's possible to successfully overhaul an entire country's health care system. In 1996, the Swiss recreated their system as a public-private hybrid, providing universal health care through a network of private insurers. The system provides what almost everyone agrees is high-quality care at a cost of less than 11% of the GDP, compared with 16% in the U.S. How does Switzerland do it? The country requires all its citizens to take out personal health insurance, cutting employers out of the picture. Insurers offer a range of programs and are forbidden from excluding anyone. The government provides a health care subsidy to help those with lower incomes buy a policy, about 40% of the population. But deductibles are far higher than in the U.S., providing a disincentive to pursuing unnecessary treatments. Medical fees are renegotiated every year between health care providers and insurance firms and must be approved by local governments. Chronic disease management is better here. Zurich physician Edward Battlegay told the New York Times, if you don't treat hypertension, you treat strokes. Not treating patients is expensive. And now let's turn to the best columns in the United States this week, according to The Week magazine. The first one is entitled, Silencing Opponents of Gay Marriage, written by Carl Cannon in RealClearPolitics.com. It's one thing to believe, as I do, that there should be no legal barriers to gay marriage in this country, said Carl Cannon. It's another to argue that defenders of traditional marriage should be marginalized, silenced, demonized, and denied their day in court. Human Rights Campaign, a gay rights organization, tried to do just that by launching a jihad against King and Spalding, the law firm hired by Republicans to defend the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act before the Supreme Court. When gay rights activists mounted a public crusade of shame and intimidation against the firm, its partners quickly caved in to pressure and said they would not defend DOMA. But what a hollow victory. The firm's lead partner, Paul Clement, resigned and will defend the law on his own, fulfilling a basic promise of America, which is that unpopular defendants and causes also get their day in court. In the past, liberals have correctly insisted that even Al-Qaeda terrorists deserve lawyers and a full legal hearing. Are terrorists really more worthy of a vigorous defense than Americans who sincerely believe that the word marriage is reserved for heterosexuals? The next column is entitled Obama's Hypocrisy on Gas Prices, written by Jack Kelly in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. President Obama is pretending to be upset about rising gas prices, said Jack Kelly, but expensive oil actually suits his administration goals. Back in 2008, Energy Secretary Stephen Chu said, "We have to figure out how to boost the price of gasoline to the levels in Europe." Why? So the green technologies and electric cars this administration fancies will seem less uneconomical. Gas prices have doubled since Obama took office, and the president has ordered another pointless investigation into whether speculators are driving up the prices. This is political posturing. In reality, he bears much of the blame. His trillion-dollar deficits have led to the weakening of the dollar, which makes foreign oil more expensive. His muddled policy toward Libya and the Mideast has worsened the uncertainty there, and his offshore drilling ban has exacerbated the oil market's feeling of scarcity, another driver of high prices. When a struggling Pennsylvanian recently questioned the president about high gas prices, Obama flippantly replied, "If you're only getting 8 miles a gallon, you might want to think about a trade-in." In other words, let them eat cake. And the third column highlighted in the Week magazine this week is called "A Backlash Against the Tea Party," written by Saul Relative in YahooNews.com. "The Tea Party is wearing out its welcome," said Saul Relative. A recent poll by USA Today Gallup found that 47% of Americans now have an unfavorable opinion of the right-wing populist movement. With negative views rising steeply since the beginning of the year, here's why. The Tea Party started off as a group of libertarian idealists opposed to fiscal irresponsibility, but with the power that came after its success in the 2010 elections, it has become a movement that threatens. Tea Partiers now not only threaten Democrats, they threaten any Republican who doesn't bow to their rigid, uncompromising views, including House Speaker John Boehner. More troubling still to the general public is that in their vehement hatred of government, Tea Partiers now threaten revered institutions that were put into place several generations ago as safety nets for workers, the poor, and the aged, including unemployment benefits, Social Security, and Medicare. Tea Partiers even want to take away the right of union workers to bargain collectively. The Tea Party has simply become a movement of threats, and regardless of their politics, people do not respond well to being threatened. And now it's time for us to turn to The Last Word, a very popular feature towards the end of the magazine in the week. This week, the title is simple, "We Got Him." How painstaking intelligence work and high-stakes decisions ended the hunt for Osama bin Laden. For years, the agonizing search for Osama bin Laden kept coming up empty. Then last July, Pakistanis working for the Central Intelligence Agency drove up behind a white Suzuki navigating the bustling streets near Peshawar, Pakistan, and wrote down the car's license plate. The man in the car was bin Laden's most trusted courier, and over the next month, CIA operatives would track him throughout central Pakistan. Ultimately, he led them to a sprawling compound at the end of a long dirt road and surrounded by tall security fences in a wealthy hamlet 35 miles from the Pakistani capital. On a moonless night, 8 months later, 79 American commandos and 4 helicopters descended on the compound, officials said. Shots rang out. A helicopter stalled and would not take off. Pakistani authorities, kept in the dark by their allies in Washington, scrambled forces as the American commandos rushed to finish their mission and leave before a confrontation. Of the 5 dead, one was a tall, bearded man with a bloodied face and a bullet in his head. A member of the Navy SEAL snapped his picture with a camera and uploaded it to analysts who fed it into a facial recognition program. And just like that, history's most expansive, expensive, and exasperating manhunt was over. On Sunday afternoon, as the helicopters raced over Pakistani territory, the president and his advisors gathered in the Situation Room of the White House to monitor the operation as it unfolded. Much of the time was spent in silence. Obama looked stone-faced. One aide said, "Vice President Joe Biden fingered his rosary beads. The minutes passed like days," recalled John Brennan, the White House counterterrorism chief. The code name for bin Laden was Geronimo. The president and his advisors watched Leon Panetta, the CIA director, on a video screen narrating from his agency's headquarters across the Potomac River what was happening in faraway Pakistan. "They've reached the target," he said. Minutes passed. "We have a visual on Geronimo," he said. A few minutes later, Geronimo, EKIA, enemy killed in action. There was silence in the Situation Room. Finally, the president spoke up. "We got him." The raid was the culmination of years of painstaking intelligence work, including the interrogation of CIA detainees in secret prisons in Eastern Europe, where sometimes what was not said was as useful as what was. Intelligence agencies eavesdropped on telephone calls and emails of the courier's Arab family in a Persian Gulf state and pored over satellite images of the compound in Abbottabad. Last July, Pakistani agents working for the CIA spotted the courier again driving his vehicle near Peshawar. When, after weeks of surveillance, he drove to the sprawling compound in Abbottabad, American intelligence operatives felt they were on to something big, perhaps even bin Laden himself. It was hardly the Spartan cave in the mountains that many had envisioned as his hiding place. Rather, it was a three-story house, ringed by 12-foot-high concrete walls, topped with barbed wire and protected by two security fences. He was, said Brennan, the White House official, hiding in plain sight. Back in Washington, Panetta met with Obama and his most senior national security aides, including Biden, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and Defense Secretary Robert Gates. Panetta spoke at length about bin Laden and his presumed hiding place. "It was electric," said an administration official who attended the meeting. "For so long we've been trying to get a handle on this guy, and all of a sudden it was like, wow, there he is." What followed was weeks of tense meetings between Panetta and his subordinates about what to do next. While Panetta advocated an aggressive strategy to confirm bin Laden's presence, some CIA clandestine officers worried that the most promising lead in years might be blown if bodyguards suspected that the compound was being watched and spirited, the Al-Qaeda leader, out of the area. For weeks last fall, spy satellites took detailed photographs, and the National Security Agency worked to scoop up any communications coming from the house. It wasn't easy. The compound had neither a phone line nor internet access. Those inside were so concerned about security that they burned their trash rather than put it on the street for collection. In February, Panetta called Vice Admiral William McRaven, commander of the Pentagon's Joint Special Operations Command, to CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, to begin planning a military strike. McRaven spent weeks working with the CIA on the operation and came up with three options: a helicopter assault using American commandos, a strike with B-2 bombers that would obliterate the compound, or a joint raid with Pakistani intelligence operatives. On March 14th, Panetta took the options to the White House. The CIA had been taking satellite photos, establishing the habits of people at the compound. Evidence was mounting that bin Laden was there. On March 22nd, the president asked his advisors their opinions on the options. Gates was skeptical about a helicopter assault, calling it risky, and instructed military officials to look into aerial bombardment using smart bombs. But a few days later, the officials returned with the news that it would take some 32 bombs of 2,000 pounds each, and how could the American officials be certain that they had killed bin Laden? "It would have created a giant crater, and it wouldn't have given us a body," said one American intelligence official. A helicopter assault emerged as the favored option. The Navy SEALs team that would hit the ground began holding dry runs at training facilities on both American coasts, which were made up to resemble the compound, but they were not told who their target might be until later. Last Thursday, the day after the president released his long-form birth certificate, such silliness, he told reporters, was distracting the country from more important things. Obama met again with his top national security officials. Panetta told the group that the CIA had red-teamed the case, shared their intelligence with other analysts who weren't involved to see if they agreed that bin Laden was probably in Abbottabad. They did. It was time to decide. Around the table, the group went over and over the negative scenarios. There were long periods of silence, one aide said, and then finally Obama spoke. "I'm not going to tell you what my decision is now. I'm going to go back and think about it some more," but he added, "I'm going to make a decision soon." 16 hours later, he had made up his mind. Early the next morning, four top aides were summoned to the White House diplomatic room. Before they could brief the president, he cut them off. "It's a go," he said. The earliest the operation could take place was Saturday, but officials cautioned that cloud cover in the area meant that Sunday was much more likely. The next day, Obama took a break from rehearsing for the White House correspondents' dinner that night to call McRaven to wish him luck. On Sunday, White House officials canceled all West Wing tours, so unsuspecting tourists, big difference there, wouldn't accidentally run into the all-level national security officials holed up in the Situation Room monitoring the feeds they were getting from Panetta. A staffer went to Costco and came back with a mix of provisions, turkey pita, wraps, gold shrimp, potato chips, soda. At 2:05 p.m., Panetta sketched out the operation to the group for a final time. Within an hour, the CIA director began his narration via video from Langley. "They've crossed into Pakistan," he said. The commando team had raced into the Pakistani night from a base in Jalalabad, just across the border in Afghanistan. It was just past midnight on Monday morning, and the Americans were counting on the element of surprise. As the first of the helicopters swooped in at low altitudes, neighbors heard a loud blast and gunshots. A woman who lives 2 miles away said she thought it was a terrorist attack on a Pakistani military installation. Her husband said no one had any clue bin Laden was hiding in the quiet, affluent area. "It's the closest you can be to Britain," he said of their neighborhood. The SEAL team stormed into the compound. The raid awakened the group inside. One American intelligence official said, and a firefight broke out. One man held an unidentified woman living there as a shield while firing at the Americans. Both were killed. Two more men died as well, and two women were wounded. American authorities later determined that one of the slain men was bin Laden's son, Hamza, and the other two were the courier and his brother. The commandos found an unarmed bin Laden on the third floor, wearing the local loose-fitting tunic and pants known as a shalwar kameez. Officials said he resisted before he was shot above the left eye near the end of the 40-minute raid. American officials insisted they would have taken bin Laden into custody if he did not resist, although they considered that likelihood remote. "If we had the opportunity to take bin Laden alive, he didn't present any threat. The individuals involved were able and prepared to do that," Brennan said. One of bin Laden's wives identified his body at the scene, American officials said. A picture taken by a SEAL commando and processed through facial recognition software suggested a 95% certainty that it was bin Laden. Later DNA tests comparing samples with relatives found a 99.9% match. But the Americans faced other problems. One of their helicopters stalled and could not take off. Rather than let it fall into the wrong hands, the commandos moved the women and children to a secure area and blew up the malfunctioning helicopter. By that point, though, the Pakistani military was scrambling forces in response to the incursion into Pakistani territory. They had no idea about what might have been going on there, Brennan said. As they took off at 1:10 a.m. local time, taking a trove of documents and computer hard drives from the house, the Americans left behind the women and children. A Pakistani official said 9 children from 2 to 12 years old are now in Pakistani custody. The Obama administration had already determined it would follow Islamic tradition of burial within 24 hours to avoid offending devout Muslims, yet concluded bin Laden would have to be buried at sea, since no country would be willing to take the body. Moreover, they did not want to create a shrine for his followers. So the Al-Qaeda leader's body was washed and placed in a white sheet in keeping with tradition. On the aircraft carrier Carl Vinson, it was placed in a weighted bag as an officer read prepared religious remarks. The body then was placed on a prepared flatboard and eased into the sea. Only a small group of people watching from one of the large elevator platforms that move aircraft up to the flight deck were witness to the end of America's most wanted fugitive. And now let's take a look at a couple of items from the Health and Science section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first item, a generation's favorite tune, I'm So Vain. Young people love themselves more today than ever before, says University of Kentucky psychologist Nathan DeWall, and the proof is in their music. He and his colleagues analyzed the lyrics of Billboard Hot 100 songs from the past three decades and found a steady increase in self-centeredness and hostility toward others. In the early 80s, lyrics, love was easy and positive and about two people. Study co-author Gene Twenge tells the New York Times the recent songs are about what the individual wants and how she or he has been disappointed or wronged. The study found a marked increase in the prevalence of the words I and me in song lyrics and fewer instances of we and us. It also registered a jump in angry lyrics about hating and killing and a drop in songs containing positive words like love or sweet. The researchers suggest that rampant narcissism may be making it harder for people to connect with one another. They point to other surveys that show that more people are apt to feel sad and lonely now than in previous decades. And our second item from the Health and Science section of the week, warding off dementia. Just getting out of the house is enough to cut in half your odds of developing Alzheimer's disease. That is the heartening conclusion of researchers at the Rush Alzheimer's Disease Center after they tracked a group of more than 1,000 initially healthy seniors over 5 years. They found that those who participated in social activities like lunching with friends, volunteering, or going to church were 50% less likely to develop signs of dementia. The most outgoing seniors reduced their risk by 75%. While becoming housebound has long been linked to cognitive decline, scientists hadn't been sure whether that was just because memory loss makes seniors feel like less like going out. Study author Brian James tells LiveScience.com that his findings suggest it's the other way around, that social inactivity itself leads to a cognitive impairment. People who never leave their comfort zone aren't engaging with their environment and meeting new people, he says. They may not be using their minds as much. Interacting with others may be a kind of mental exercise that keeps the brain fit. As James puts it, you can either choose or give your mind a regular workout, or you can lose it. And now as we move toward the end of our program this week, let's take a look at the Talking Points section of the week. 2012, the Republican Dilemma. As Republicans survey the field of possible 2012 presidential candidates, said Michael Shear in the New York Times, they're feeling a rising sense of panic. Fairly late in the usual election cycle, they're still waiting for Mr. or Ms. Right. And even conservative stalwarts like Rush Limbaugh are calling the contenders one of the weakest fields in recent times. It didn't help that Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour suddenly dropped out last week, citing a lack of fire in the belly, said Gloria Borger in CNN.com. Translation, he didn't think he could beat an incumbent president. With former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee and other possible candidates still dithering, Republicans may be stuck with a choice between boring establishment candidates like Mitt Romney and former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, or fiery insurgents like Tea Party favorite Michelle Bachmann and Donald Trump. The conventional wisdom is wrong, said Jay Cost in WeeklyStandard.com. It's true that the GOP has no perfect candidate, but Obama and the Democrats have good reason to worry about the emerging Republican field. The GOP has four serious contenders who would be formidable in a general election. Romney, Pawlenty, Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, and former Utah Governor John Huntsman. Naysayers carp about their supposed lack of charisma, but now that voters have lived through the glitzy chaos of Obama's rock star approach to governance, they just may prefer a solid conservative with real fiscal credibility. Republican voters may not be excited yet, said David Shribman in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, but that will instantly change once the GOP nominates someone. It really does depend on who is nominated, said Alvin Felsenberg in USNews.com. The two most plausible presidents the Republicans could field, Florida's Jeb Bush and General David Petraeus, show no inclination to run, and the GOP's roster of young, attractive office holders, Chris Christie, Marco Rubio, and Nikki Haley, say they're not interested, probably because they'll have a much better chance in 2016. The GOP's young up-and-comers are wise to keep their powder dry, said Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post. That may mean Republicans have to draft Representative Paul Ryan, their de facto leader, in the looming budget battles. Unfortunately, Ryan has zero inclination to run, so can anyone rustle up a posse. And now some short items from Talking Points. Since the shooting of Representative Gabrielle Giffords, congressmen and women are asking for local police to provide security for any public appearance. Some congressional staff members obtained permits and are now routinely armed. The New York Times has run stories based on documents obtained by WikiLeaks 54 times this year, or in 47% of its issues. About half of all people killed by tornadoes live in mobile homes which are ripped apart and sucked into the air because of their flimsy construction. That item appeared in the New York Times, and acknowledging the ever-increasing girth of Americans, the Coast Guard has raised its weight limit of the average boat passenger from 160 pounds to 185. That change will reduce the maximum passenger capacity of ferries and charter boats as well. And now the poll watch, 72% of Americans say they feel relieved by the killing of Osama bin Laden. 60% say they feel proud. 58% say they feel happy. 16% say news of the death makes them feel afraid. And 80% of Americans say they would not be willing to pay anything to read a newspaper content online. 14% say they would pay between $1 and $10 per month, but no more than that. Well, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. I certainly hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long until next time.